Hello and welcome to the inaugural Atlas podcast. My name is Alex. I'm a content writer for Atlas, and I'm here with Martin Kelman, our Atlas lead and chief digital transformation officer for ATS Global. In this week's episode, we're going to be talking about the latest news in 5G, including the 5GEM project and our involvement in it. Martin will be discussing the difference between SaaS and COTS. And finally, we have a chat with ATS Global's chair of the board of directors, Mike James.
That should be interesting. So, what's in the news then, Alex? What should we talk about?
I thought it would be good to look at the video that Vodafone put out on the progress of the 5GEM project, because I know that's something we've been involved in, and it's very interesting and topical with all that's going on in 5G right now.
Yes, so there's a lot of talk in 5G world at the moment, and I think it's good for us, you know, to be involved with these types of projects. So I'll give it a bit of a rundown of what the project is. It was something we got involved with through TWI. We've engaged with them on a number of innovation projects in the past, and they invited us into this consortium at the end of last year around this 5G project, and we jumped at the chance of getting involved with it. And the other, as you said, the other consortium partners, which are led by Ford Motor Cars, are Vodafone, who are providing the 5G network, Vacuum Furnace Engineering, or VFE, who are providing some of those physical things and equipment that actually do things. Us, from the point of view of doing the data backbone and the machine learning and implementing all of that within the 5G network itself. There are some other ones that are quite interesting. So TM Forum, who are, they're kind of an experts in the telecom industry. So they try and drive standards and frameworks, and they have a suite of APIs to try and unify the way that the telecom industry operates. So they're kind of slightly like a non-profit business who do things.
Okay.
And then, then Lancaster University, who are also supporting us, the AI, and one more business, which is the HSSMI, who are another digital business working in the manufacturing space as a part of this project. So yeah, a really strong consortium.
Wow. They mentioned in the video, which we will link below, by the way, the video was around the E-Prime facility, which looks like the centre for the 5GEM project.
Yeah, so there's two parts to it. There's one which is going to be looking at the E-Prime E-Prime line in the Ford facility. And there's a second part to it, which is actually inside the TWI facility. So there are two parts to it. The video focuses really on the Ford aspect of it, because that's the kind of more commercial end of it. Within the Ford facility, there are two use cases that they're really focusing on. One is around laser welding, and the other one is around the vacuum furnaces. So there can be different types of laser welding involved, but yeah, two slightly different use cases to try to see if the 5G technology can work on different types of equipment, really, whether that's retrofitting sensors or connecting directly to those machines.
Okay. I think a big point that they were discussing as well is how data collection and 5G go sort of hand in hand, because obviously they're collecting huge amounts of data in real time from these machines, and 5G really facilitates that kind of communication speed and low latency.
Yeah, so what they've mapped out are sort of five statements about their current state and how in the future with 5G this will be able to create faster, better connections. So yeah, fixed connections for them are too long and too complicated to maintain. So with 5G, they really want to be able to change connections to those types of equipment far quicker and far safer and far more secure than they previously did. Equipment is not easy to reconfigure. We always think that factories are fairly static things, but they're often getting reconfigured. And I think during COVID, that was a prime example for Ford, where they did, you know, had to change their whole manufacturing environment to manufacture ventilators or something like that. So factories are often getting reconfigured, and the speed of reconfigure is often held up by physical things like network and data constraints and reconfiguring things. And of course, they really want it to be secure. Secure so they can add some additional capability on the network, like VR, AR, AI, and to actually connect machines that aren't very good at handling data to the world of IT and AI, which is very good at handling data, which means that we can start to create value from that data. Things like predictive maintenance, predictive quality, all of those types of things. So with all those types of benefits, that's why they see their current state is fine and it's connected and they have a lot of data-rich environment, but it's not very flexible, it's not very scalable, and to change things is very difficult. And to achieve that, and to achieve the promises of AI and VR type of things, we need to be able to connect these things into the internet. And 5G, with its low latency, high bandwidth approach, is the kind of ideal platform for that.
Okay. And I guess, yeah, that brings us nicely onto what is our involvement in the project? Because I know we're handling a lot of the data and the communications between elements.
So we've been over the last few years developing the cloud, you know, cloud infrastructure and cloud approach, which underneath has got a whole load of technology that allows for things to be very scalable and very elastic. What our interest in the project is how do those two worlds combine? How does the world of cloud combine with the world of 5G and edge computing? Because one step in the future might be that actually edge computing becomes far more powerful and therefore can create real digital twins of those equipment. Therefore, what we're trying with this project is to test out that approach, which is collect the data into the cloud, understand the context of that data, create some AI models based on that data we're receiving. So basically using anomaly detection approaches, so we can identify what that model is, and then actually try and deliver that model to the edge so that we can run a true digital twin of that equipment and detect anomalies without needing to be plugged into the cloud continuously. And that's kind of what we call the edge computing aspect that we're looking to prove out. And if that edge computer can live within the 5G network, even better.
Fascinating. This isn't the first time we've had an input on digitally twinned facilities, so I guess it's really advancing that preparatory work we've done elsewhere or interesting projects we've been involved with previously.
Yeah, and it's to do with the 5G aspect of it. So we've done it within Wi-Fi networks and things like that, even using 4G type of modem dial-up type of approaches. but really, actually, this is, I would say, the first step in that journey, really to, there's a lot further to go with this, because if we can create a level of trust and capability within edge computing, then in the future, maybe within 5 years, then we can start to really consider edge computing controlling the machines and replacing the traditional technologies of programmable ledger controllers that have been around for 30 years with newer advanced ways of creating those control algorithms, which, like I said, will start to lead towards this kind of predictive element, which is missing from today's manufacturing.
Okay. And I guess that's really a huge part of 4IR, isn't it? The fourth industrial revolution is the meeting of physical and digital worlds.
Yeah, exactly. And that's there's all kinds of words thrown around about it, autonomous and all of these types of things. But ultimately, it's going to take a few years to get there. For one reason, we need these demonstrators to try it out. second reason, we've got to raise that technology readiness level so we can have a world of plug and play things that auto configure and can talk to each other and know what language to talk to each other with, and then we've got to create a level of trust that the PLCs have created over the years. And we touch on a bit of that with the interview with Mike, actually, so it's interesting that that came up during those discussions.
Excellent stuff. I mean, it's a fascinating project. We will continue to work on it, and I think any big milestones will certainly come back to discuss it here in future episodes.
Yeah. We'd like to do some more of it as well, I think, is where we're really at. Is I think, so this first step in the journey, and there will be more and more 5G projects that are being released all the time. So I'm really looking to get involved with all facets of the 5G projects.
Now's the time. And actually, I think we're going to come back next week as well and have a closer look into 5G in general. I know you've got a few ideas about that. So yeah, really looking forward to that one. Now Martin's going to give us a rundown of SaaS versus COTS, what the pros and cons are for each approach, and what our general thoughts are about each. Over to you, Martin.
Thank you, Alex. Today we're going to talk about SaaS versus COTS and what both mean. And really what we have to look at with this is both the business model and the technology that enables both of these approaches. What we'll start with is the COTS products. So commercially off-the-shelf products have been around for a number of years, and you kind of have to think back to why they originated. And some of the concepts behind that is around to ensure that you can get a level of reusability about it. A lot of COTS products started themselves just as a software running in a particular facility, a one-off thing that actually somebody saw a level of repeatability. And what they then did was start to go, oh, I've got two or three or four or five of these deployments now. We'll call it a product, and that product can cover a certain level of requirements. And what happens then is those requirements come in, and the COTS product gets more mature. Maybe it gets more features and functions over time, and those features and functions develop. But the main aspect of a COTS product was really around the way that it was distributed. And that came around about the technologies that are used on the computer. So a lot of COTS products originally were distributed on CDs or whatever it is as installation. And there'd be a whole load of installation required around the different database technologies, the frameworks used, and all of those different aspects that were required to make the product work. Once the product had been installed, which could take anywhere between an hour or 2 weeks, depending on the complexity of the product, because it started to get quite vague about what an installation was, then you had to configure it. And that configuration might come in two ways. It might come in some level of customization, because the COTS product itself didn't have complete coverage of the requirements, so it'd be extended, which led to all kinds of issues. And I guess the classic one is with SAP's ERP, because the SAP's ERP really, those who use SAP will know there's lots of Zs, and those Zs are those additional configurations or development within the platform itself. So what that ended up with is that we then had those you had the COTS product, you had the extensions that were required to cover any additional requirements, then you also had the configuration of the system. And that could take a long time. So some of the larger projects, so those are running into the millions, actually that whole process of capturing those requirements, evaluating whether those requirements meet the COTS products, understanding who owned the intellectual property of those extensions, and configuring the system either through interfaces or configuring the master data in the system, could take anything up to 18 months or even longer than that for those IT projects to get underway. And that included all of the different architectures required to underpin it. So all of the different servers, all of the different networking capabilities, the data storage, the archiving, the backup, the security, and all of those other aspects that were in addition to the actual COTS product itself. What SaaS is,
is really bundling all of that up, all of the computing power, all of the architecture, all of the support, all of the updates to the system and the patching of the system, is all wrapped up in one thing. So you're not buying a COTS product in the traditional sense. You're not buying a license of which then you have to install on a computer or anything like this. With a software as a service, especially on cloud platforms as such, what you're really doing is everything's already there for you. Everything apart from the configuration of the system. So you can get access to the system instantly. Okay, that might be within a few hours, depending on the types of cloud environments we're talking about. But once you have the system there, you can start using it and configuring it straight away. So if you can compare that to the traditional approaches with COTS, you can actually start working with clouds from day one. So what that means is the time to value between you spending out on the product and using the product is reduced dramatically. That brings us on to the second part of this, which is not the technical thing, but the business models that underline both COTS and SaaS. So with a COTS product, after there'd been some kind of level of product evaluation, generally through some kind of RFP, so process for request for a proposal or request for information process, then there'd be some kind of maybe some pilot projects that would look at the scope of the project to see if it covered, to try and de-risk whether that COTS product really covered the business requirements or not. Once all that process is gone, which costs money, then there'd be a purchase of a license, and those licenses could be pretty expensive. And that license just allowed you then to start that whole architectural process of installation or architecture, installation, test, configuration, development, or whatever it is on, wasn't it? So there's a lot of capital outlay at the beginning, and there's a lot of risk before you get to the value. With SaaS, like I said, the SaaS allows for two different approach because of the elastic computing that sits beneath the SaaS application. That means things can easily be span up, and that's the difference now. We've got different terminology. So rather than installation and architecture and things like this, in a SaaS world, we just spin up the environment and make it available to the end user to start their configuration. Because of that, what we have is a different level of agility around how things are developed. And that agility allows for those different business models to be created. So like I said, with a SaaS, generally there's also a SaaS model, which moves the cost from the CapEx, as in traditionally with the SaaS world, with the COTS world, to more of an OpEx world, which is an operational cost to do with the running of the system. And that means that the capital outlay from day one is reduced. That means that the value created is easier to manage and the risk is easier to manage because everything is created very in an agile way. But what happens with those gaps in the requirements? So we covered the kind of architecture, the computing power, the installation, and the configuration. But we still have to consider what happens with those gaps in the requirements. Well, with the SaaS approach, let's look at the COTS approach first. So the COTS approach, generally, there would be a software release every 6 to 12 months. And if you remember the classic Microsoft Office or Microsoft operating system, Windows 95 and all of those type of things, you know, there would be a 2-year to 3-year release cycle. There may be some patches to bugs fixes, but new features and functionalities were released on a cycle of 2 to 3 years. And that was because of the whole process of capturing. But what that means is those releases tend to be bigger, so they'd have more packed into them, so the impact on the system was, or on the end user was bigger, and often it was more difficult to upgrade because of that, because of the configurations in the system and all of that kind of thing. Upgrades could be as costly as the original project themselves. But with a SaaS situation, what you're having is an agile development stream. And this lives in what's called the DevOps now, to shorten it, the development operations of it. But these DevOps are to a level now that the whole DevOps chain is completely automated. Obviously, there's a level of coding required from individuals now. That part of it isn't automated. But moving through from development into test, or into unit test, into integration test, into user acceptance test, all of that process and the management of that process and the configuration of that process is an automated process. There's still requirement for new features to be manually tested, because manual people are far more effective at testing. But that cycle of getting a new requirement and developing that new requirement can be as short as 2 weeks. And that's kind of the cycle that we have within the business. So we have a 2-week release cycle. And because of that, we can actually advertise when what features are coming and when they're released. That doesn't mean to say all features are developed at once. That just means to say a prioritized feature on the backlog gets developed very quickly and rapidly deployed to the solution. What that does mean is that those new features and functionalities are covered as a part of the product, and therefore any upgrades to the system are far easier, because there's not so much of the customization of the and extensions to the system as previously required. So we end up with two things then. We end up with a SaaS platform built on elastic computing, and then that requires a level of configuration. And therefore, this is why things like the architectural debt that was built up using the COTS products has become such a big issue for businesses, and why there's such an attraction to move to cloud. There's lots of other reasons to move to a cloud platform, but the actual reduction of architectural debt, the speed of deployment, the speed of new requirements being issued, and also the fact that those new requirements are owned by the product team and don't fall into this uncanny valley between who owns the intellectual property on things, is some of the really good reasons why people are starting to move to SaaS, or have already moved to SaaS, but there's still a long way to go in that area. So hopefully that's been of interest. A lot packed into this session again. Back over to you, Alex.
Okay, so for this interview portion of the inaugural Atlas podcast, we have joining us Mike James, Chair of the Board of Directors for ATS Global. And if you would like to introduce yourself, Mike, give us a bit of your history.
Yes, certainly, Alex. I'm spent my career in manufacturing, helping all sorts of different types of manufacturers with their IT and OT. We talk about OT, then it's operational technology. And of course, today, manufacturers are run by data and information. And it's been a time really when we're just starting on the Industry 4.0 journey. And I spent the whole of my career doing that.
Yeah, and Mike, where did you first come into the kind of manufacturing world? Where was that first glimpse of what we're doing today, and you know, the 30 odd year history of ATS?
I was at Plessey Electronics, and we were developing secret systems, but they're not very secret anymore. So they were battle station communication systems, and they were designed so that if one of the communication stations was knocked out, that the communication would continue. And of course, it was the basic technology for the internet.
And so what was that moment where you thought, I need to do something for myself? I need to break the strains or the chains of other world and do something for
myself. Well, yeah, it was after a series of terrible bosses, Martin. And one sort of thinks, maybe I can do this better. And in fact, I did learn a lot from many of my bosses and my colleagues. But I also saw how I felt things could be done better. And I wanted to do that.
And that led you to start ATS, was that, or was that a step before that, you think?
Yeah, I did have a few goes at different entrepreneurial activities, which crashed and burnt. And then with three colleagues in the Netherlands, we started up ATS Global on the back of the first programming software using DOS for PLCs. Long time ago, and there's been many changes and developments since then, but we still program PLCs with application software from some of those same suppliers.
I mean, that's the bit that I was going to focus in on, actually. Out of everything that we've seen the world change from an IT point of view, in the OT world, PLCs have been pretty consistent. What do you put that down to? Is that the technology or trust, or how do you think PLCs have lasted so long?
Well, I think originally it's reliability and the fact that they don't have any moving components, so they last a very long time. In a manufacturing environment, you need systems that are not going to fail. Yeah, if you recall, and still today, I don't think you would expect a PC to run for 30 to 40 years. But we still have PLCs out there that have run without failing for that length of time. And that gives it, you know, the reliability and stability that you need in the manufacturing environment.
Yeah, so there's a lot of trust built into that, isn't there? Very much. And it is kind of that great divide, isn't it, a little bit between the operational technology or the OT world you talk about and the IT world, because you'd never get really IT people even understanding what a PLC is, even if you explain it to them.
Yeah, I mean, I always think the one really good example between the different ways of thinking is that an OT, the operational technology, real time means real time. The time it takes for me to talk to you, the time it takes for that message to leave my brain mouth and come into your ears and your brain, that's not real time. With the PLC technology, we can measure that expected transfer time, and we can operate in true real time, making decisions at a very fast pace that we need in the physical environment. IT people will often consider real time to be perhaps a second or two, but that's just too long for us in the OT world.
That's
an example.
Yeah, there's the reliability, but there's also the performance of it. And I often think of that kind of, you've got the input, the scan, and the output. But, you know, those three things work in coordination with each other. But they don't work in the same way as a high-level program, which is kind of events and triggers of running a bit of code. A PLC is kind of very built very differently from that point of view.
And the sensors that are coming in, we talk about our own sensors, but a PLC has a lot of other sensors. It has infrared input, for instance, pH values as an input. There's so much data that it can handle and process very quickly. But I don't think, to be fair though, IT people, I think, are really beginning to learn what is going on and the differences between these technologies. And in the same way that I think OT people are also understanding the differences about the IT world, about infrastructure and how that's all set up. And the need for reliability in the IT is of course, just as high.
Would you say that's a pretty modern meeting of the worlds then, the IT and the OT coming together?
Yes. It's still, an engineer understands, I think, the physical world better. Yeah, and I think that IT people understand the virtual world better. And it's important to talk and gain different understandings get a real understanding of how those two worlds meet each other. Real time, event driven data, these are all very different types of ways of dealing with data. And the important thing is that they understand that.
And that kind of encompasses this world. If we talk about the Industry 4 world, if you like, in the Internet of Things or the Industrial Internet of Things is I guess trying to break that up a little bit, isn't it? Because it has the sensors, the actuators built within it. But then if you add that into something like a 5G network with low latency and guaranteed network delivery, maybe we have a similar system to a PLC, but in an IT cloak.
Yeah, we have an amazing opportunity with 5G to really change the way that manufacturing plants are connected, both internally and to the external world. I think a really critical point is the security which it offers, which we don't have, with the current types of communication technology.
Yeah, and also PLCs, trying to plug PLCs into the internet is still not a natural thing for them to live on, is it? It's the protocols and the exchanges aren't there. Yeah. Where the 5G world or the IoT world, with MQTT protocols and things like that are built on internet security, so they're a bit more at home living in that world, I guess.
Yeah, we can get into the technical differences between the two, but I think if you look at it from a high level, then these technologies are real enablers for us to introduce, for instance, artificial intelligence, decision-making processes. I'm very much a promoter of replacing people for decision-making. I think that you can develop structured programs, but also introducing artificial intelligence, where you take the most optimal decision. It's very difficult in a manufacturing plant to make the ideal decision, but you can constantly improve optimization of the equipment, of the people, of the quality of the product that you're making. And I'm not a believer, for instance, in just representing data and giving people information so that they can make a decision from the other side of the world. I'd much rather see that integrated planning, for instance, a decision, what am I going to make today? It's really important because you've got customer demand on the one side. That's an IT-driven activity. And on the other side, you've got the capacity of the plant, the material that you have available to you. Maybe a machine is down, maybe the very person who's qualified to use a certain piece of kit is sick today. So you have to optimize, constantly optimize to get the most out of your manufacturing facility.
And that's an interesting point, because I think there's two schools of thought on that. There is the one that you give the information or the prediction to the human to make the decision, and therefore you optimize the information delivery, or you rely on the AI to make the decision. You're more on the, you're thinking the AI is going to be the thing that makes
it. I think it's an intermediate stage, Martin, that we'll provide information to people until they trust the virtual world to make the decision for them. I think it's very hard for us to let go of that. But I think we're very close in many situations that the computer, as it were, will make a better decision than the person, but the person needs to train the computer too.
We're back to the word trust there, aren't we? Which we kind of started there with the world of PLCs and things like that. And it shows you there's still a human emotion to these, even if it's a level of trusting in technology.
Absolutely. And of course, it's hard to blame a computer. I mean, we still like to stick our finger at somebody and blame them, as we know that many politicians like doing that. It's never their own fault.
And so when we started talking about Industry 4 a few years ago now, I think it's all around 2013, it started to emerge. And we started to try and adapt us and the business around that. And what was the point that you thought, we do need to think about this industrial revolution and how we can do things differently? And what were those things you think?
I took a lot of time to read. Understand, listen, go to conferences, hear what people were saying. And of course, in many ways, so was Atlas born as a potential tool which enables us to put the thinking into place, which allows us to develop the solutions that we need to meet Industry 4.0 as a revolution, as a goal. When the report was brought out in 2013, it was clearly written, it's a journey. It's a journey of 20 years. Well, we're 7 years into the journey, and I think it's the journey got longer. I don't think it's going to happen as quickly as we expected it to. One of the things that the report said was we have to develop the solutions. We have to do that collaboratively. So in the supply chain, so the manufacturers themselves, their suppliers, the service companies that support them. And I think that, you know, Atlas is absolutely ideal for doing that, because you can plan out your whole process, your supply chain, how it knits together, how it fits together, who are the actors, what are the players in it, what do they need to do. And it gives us that opportunity to build that collaborative supply chain using this tool, as well as internally in the manufacturing plant itself. And in the end, you need to orchestrate everything. There are 1,000 things that will change every day, and that when something changes, you need to orchestrate what all the other actors in the system are likely to do. Yeah. Things change unexpectedly. Things change because we want them to change, but they sure as hell change all the time.
That's one thing you can't predict is events, is it? And that's
you can predict that something will happen, Martin.
But what will
you
happen?
Just don't know what will happen.
Anything from you, Alex? Well, you know, we're getting close to the end of the interview, so have you got a question, your opportunity here to ask Mike one last question?
Oh, I wish I had one, but no, that's fascinating stuff, and it's interesting to see how these worlds sort of meld together. And as a newbie to the industry, looking at it as 7 years into the 20-year journey, it's interesting to see how far we've come along that, but still how far we have to go.
Yeah. So what is the future though, Mike? Let's look a little bit at the crystal ball time. What's your predictions?
Well, first of all, my advice, Martin, is to listen to, to listen to other people, try to absorb what they're trying to say and to understand it, because we had some wonderful visits to customers together, to manufacturing companies, some very important ones. And, I learned so much, you know, from you, and we learned so much from those companies as well. So the key to me to Industry 4.0 is to understand the purpose. What is the purpose? What will it bring you? How can you change your business model, to your advantage in and within the industry 4.0 movement? And it's also about the environment. It's about people working less, people having better life work balance, that we recycle. It's not just about using technology and the manufacturing plant as such. It's a complete plan. For the industrial society. Yeah. So read the report, read the bloody report and understand it.
That's brilliant.
Thanks so much for joining us. I'm sure we'll see you again soon.
Thank you.
Cheers, Mike. Bye-bye.
Goodbye, Alex. Bye, Martin.
Well, thank you for joining us for the first Atlas podcast. And thank you, Martin, for all of your insightful comments this week.
And thank you, Alex. That was good fun. Well, it was something different, and hopefully people find what we've got to say a bit interesting, and we'll keep pressing until they do.
For sure. If you have any comments, head over to weareatlas.com. Click on the little button in the bottom right-hand corner and you can send us a message. We thought we would end today's episode on a quote, and I was thinking something apposite for Atlas. We are very keen on the lean approach, failing often, and finding success through iterative design. So I found a quote from an American basketball coach, John Wooden, and he says, "Failure isn't fatal, but failure to change might be."
Nice one. Like it. Always a surprise, these quotes. So
I will surprise you next week as well.
Yes, I look forward to it.
Excellent. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.